So today is the 28th of September, 2022. And as you know, my name is Maureen Kaki, and I'm working as an oral history fellow for the Institute of Diversity and Civic Life. I'm currently in Boca Raton, Florida, on a Zoom call, and I'm here with Sal Suleiman Masood. Sal, do you prefer Sal or Suleiman?
Suleiman is good.
Yeah. Okay. Suleiman, would you like to introduce yourself and tell me where you're joining the call from today?
Well, my name is Suleiman Masood, and I'm currently living in El Paso, Texas.
Thank you so much. And just to start, like I said, this is a matter of personal story. So just to start, would you mind telling me a little bit about your childhood, maybe like one of the earliest things that you remember?
The earliest memories of my childhood?
Yeah, or just like noticeable things about your childhood, anything.
Was actually in Palestine, in the village of Burka. You know, I soon after I was born, like I was only months old, my dad sent me with my mom back to Burka to live with my grandma because she was ill. So I kind of spent the first 3 years, you know, in Palestine, in that family house, which was actually parts of that house was built close to 600 years ago, and other parts are actually newer, but the whole entire family lived in that house as like a compound. So you got all these mothers that you could have, and all these uncles that could treat you like they're, you know, they're your father. So you had to answer to everybody. So it was kind of a unique experience for me to grow up and see my grandma, because she died when I was, you know, just about 3 years old, and we moved to Kuwait after that. But that was, and I, funny that I still have vivid memories, you know, from that time of my life, and I still go back to it even now, every time I go to that house, and I just kind of remember myself climbing up those stairs, and because it's very, very, dangerous stairs to climb for a child. You know, it's almost equivalent of 4-story high, but the stairs were like just one go, you know, one go from bottom to top. It just, each stair was actually a stone buried into the wall, you know, and just carved in there. And so it was kind of, and the rail was wood, and it was very shaky, you know, but anyway, we made it. Yeah.
And you said from Palestine you went to Kuwait?
Yes. So once my grandma died, you know, my father had already been in Kuwait since the early 50s, actually. Mm-hmm. So he came back and he, you know, and we flew, actually. We flew out of Calandia, you know, from the airport just outside of Jerusalem, you know, and it was still under Jordanian rule at the time, you know. So that was, it would have been 1963. And I remember also vividly getting in that airplane. We had the two propellers on the sides and, you know, just excited to be on a plane. And then we moved to Kuwait. My dad had rented a flat on top of a supermarket, actually. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I did was climb on the rail of the balcony. I thought I could do all that, like I was running around in Palestine with no supervision whatsoever. You know, yeah.
And about how old were you when you guys moved to Kuwait?
About three years old.
Oh wow! Okay. And yeah. can you describe more about your time in Kuwait?
Well, you know, before school, before joining school, so my dad, I had sisters. By age three, I had already three sisters, one older and two younger, okay? And when we were living in that one apartment above the store, and because my dad, my mom didn't like it because they'd have to lock the balcony all the time, otherwise I'd be, you know, on the rail. And finally, they said, "No, we're going to move and get into a first-story house," you know. Mm-hmm. And they moved, and we moved near, closer to where the beach, mm-hmm. not exactly on the beach, but you know, not far.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved into, again, another flat. It was on the first floor. There was many more neighbors in that, so we could make friends and run around. And by age, I would say 5 or 5 and a half, my dad wanted me to kind of excel and go to a good school. He enrolled me in actually a Catholic school, which is a Rahbat al-Wardiya. You know, so we were actually taught by nuns for a couple of years. And it didn't take very long before he realized, you know, I need to be moving out of there. Then he put me in another school, you know, also Lebanese school, it's private school. I was not allowed to go to government schools. So it was called Al Jamil School, it's private. So that school, it turned out to be, you know, probably one of the best things that happened to me, because education was really good at that school. They taught us, you know, languages, and every year, you know, since I was, you know, like in middle school, the top five, there should be one from that school in the country. Wow. So they had really strict ways of teaching, you know. And my memory of living in Kuwait, you know, mostly was kind of mixed feelings. First, U.S. Palestinian, you were always told, you know, this is not home. You know, we're here temporarily. You know, how long is temporary? You know, it seems like we're not buying this because, oh, we'll just buy a better one when we move back to Palestine. Mm-hmm. Oh, we need this until we, you know, so everything was temporary. Everything was just still waiting till life gets better. And in our whole life, we're thinking of utopia, and life gets better only if we move back, you know. And of course, you know, I'm talking about, this is when my dad put me in Al Jamil school, it was still the 60s. Mm-hmm. And I remember vividly 1967 when the war happened. And of course, and they felt that grim feeling that they can't go back because it became occupied. And if you're outside, you cannot go back unless you fix your papers. And so that was kind of, I still remember my father, my mother listening to the news, and my uncles, and everybody's tearing up and thinking, oh, what are we going to do now? I mean, are we stuck here forever? You know, it was kind of a daunting moment where they figure out, okay, we better kind of start living our life a little bit, you know, buying things and, you know, getting better furniture, getting, you know, stuff like that. And by 1970, my dad moved us into a bigger flat, you know, that had more leg room.
Mm-hmm.
He always worked for the government. He was in the auditing department, you know, where HR, basically. Mm-hmm. So more like a clerk. It wasn't a big job. But for us, you know, in that newer house that we moved into 1970, was a predominantly Palestinian neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say 90% of the population in there were Palestinians. But like to the side of it, there was a few buildings that were mostly Kuwaiti Bedouins. And it was still kind of strange where they don't accept us. And if we ever, you know, wander into their neighborhood, they would throw stones at us, and we the same if they come our way. And so it was kind of hostile, to be honest with you, you know, as children, you know, kind of like that. But then as we grew older and we became more, and things changed, and life, you know, kind of, we just adapted to that way of life, and the kids figure out how to spend their time in the summer between, you know, marbles, playing kites, playing soccer, and just, you know, the hot of the summer, just playing soccer, like in the dead heat. I can remember that we were playing so hard to the point we stopped bleeding from our noses, you know, some of us, but who cares, you know? You know? And then in 1972, my grandfather was still alive. And he was successfully, you know, got our paperwork fixed where we can go back to Palestine, go back to live in Palestine if we wanted to. It's called Lem Shimmel, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so us and my uncle's family, where I had three cousins that are close to my age, we grew up like brothers, they decided to move and just go back to that big house and live there.
Mm-hmm.
And, right off the bat, you know, like we went, that we took that one trip in 1972 to go, you know, cross the border and so that was my first encounter with Israeli soldiers at the border, you know, at age 11, having to be strip searched at age 11, believe it or not. And it was kind of, you know, how should I say it? Traumatizing. You know, my biggest worry is I didn't want the female soldier to come near. You know, I didn't mind the male ones. But anyway, it was like, for us, thinking going back to Palestine, going back to the village, it's like really stepping into heaven, you know? And so excited, so happy. But we only stayed like for 3 or 4 weeks. But in those less than 4 weeks, you know, in those 3 weeks, my dad had arranged that we take a trip, and we went all around Palestine. We went all the way north of the Lebanese border and to Mount Carmel and Safad and Haifa, Yaffa, all the way. And then took a second trip, and we went to Gaza, went to the beach. And, you know, it was exciting. It was at that time, you could still, you know, kind of go and visit, you know. So I remember vividly, like, you know, every other summer we would go to Palestine, and I couldn't wait till the summer comes where we just go and be able to spend time with my cousins in the village, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that some of your siblings wanted to go back to Palestine, and I mean, you chose a different path eventually, right?
Well, not my siblings. My uncle.
Your uncles.
Who we were very close, and my cousins, I grew up with them like my brothers. So they lived in a building next to ours, you know, not very far. We spent a lot of time together, and the things that the families would do in Kuwait in the summertime is they would go to these seaside cafes, you know, and, you know, they would just get coffee and tea, and they play, you know, backgammon or cards, and us, the kids, would just, you know, play in the playground, or, you know, get into the water and go get crabs or you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was almost every evening, you know, on just like Thursday nights and Friday nights. So when they got their documents fixed in 1972 with that trip, they decided we're going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
They're not coming back to Kuwait. They just came back briefly, packed the things, and they went back to the big house. And every summer we'd go and live in that big house, in the same house that I was there when I was 3 years old. You know, they live in a different section of the house. So other relatives and other cousins and uncles and aunts, mostly old people, mm-hmm. you know. And it was, you know, a great experience. Still people back then really farmed. You know, my uncle, of course, gotten into it, and he started to take care of the land. And remember, we'd come in the summer, and we'd either go pick onions or go get the wheat. You know, I mean, we didn't we didn't harvest the wheat. They had a machine doing it, but we would bag it and sew the bags shut and load them on the trailer, you know. But I got to experience some of the things that my father got to experience to an extent, you know, going hiking the mountains and going to all these places that my dad talked about when he was a kid, and, you know, things like that, the things I wish my kids could do. I mean, right now, when I took my son, I wish I could have taken him hiking where I went to this one post above the village where it was built at the time of Saladin and the Crusade, you know. And you go up to the top of that mountain, even though this is in the West Bank on the hills in Burqa, which is kind of a northern part of the West Bank. Mm-hmm. But it's such a high mountain in comparison to the rest of the hills around. Once you get on top of that mountain, you could literally see Nazareth. You could see the sea. You could see Haifa. And
from the West Bank?
Yeah. It's not that far. Honestly, okay. It's not that far. You know what I mean? But once you get that high and there's not much haze, it's wonderful. You see Nazareth. You could see the domes in that for the churches in Nazareth that far away, you know? And it was such a treat because it had this old building that was built by, you know, Saladin's soldier because when you get there, you get a 360 vision of all around you. You can tell if an army's coming a couple of days ahead, you know, if you see that far. So it was a good post, you know. So we'd go up there and they had dug a well and we'd collect water like a cistern. And we knew that we'd get there and we'd crawl down that well and get some water, you know. And it's things like that are the experience that my father talked about when he was a child. I got to do, you know. I got to do, you know, trips where I go to different villages on the donkey and come back and, you know, Israh, you know. But my kids never got to experience that. Mm-hmm. I wish they could have, you know, had that. Right now, I tried to take my son on a hike and I actually rented a 4x4. And we went up the mountain, but people would start to warn us that the settlers, you know, because they had built a settlement right on top of the village. They say if they see you around that area, they'll come and harass you, you know. And of course, they have guns, you know. So I didn't want him to get that experience. Mm. Mm. So, you know, that's how I kind of, you know, grew up between Kuwait and Palestine, and I could say I had pleasant memories in both. Of course, the longest time would be in Kuwait. My buddies were in Kuwait, but my cousins grew up with like best friends as well. I still keep up with everybody from my childhood, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to find them, but after a while, Facebook helped. You know, I could locate people, you know, through Facebook. But for years, I got disconnected from a lot of my, you know, friends that I grew up in Kuwait, because, you know, in 1990, when the war happened, you know, everybody got scattered, you know, and there was nobody left in there. So in 1978, my uncle, who had actually moved to the U.S. for medical reason, because he was with Fatah back in the 60s, you know, one of the first people that joined and fought in Lebanon and in Jordan and of course, you know, in the interior, until in 1969, he got into a major accident after a funeral, and everybody died in the car except he survived somehow, but he was crippled. We spent months and months in the hospital, you know, motionless, basically, just voice. Eventually, he got better and things started to move, and then they gave him a bit of money to go get treatment in the U.S. They said there's, you know, certain orthopedic and nerve doctors in Dallas, actually, at the time. And he came. Well, he didn't go see the doctors. He just went and registered at the university and started his studies. And that was the end of it. You know, he just stayed, you know, kept going to school, got two masters and a PhD, and then finally got his citizenship through the university where he had worked, you know, as a foreign student, not gonna say advisor, but more foreign student liaison, you know, and when they bring, you know, foreign students, especially from the Middle East, you know, he would be the one guiding them on how to. So everybody that came to Denton knew my Uncle Ali, which, by the way, he just passed away less than a month ago. So we always idolized him being, you know, fidai, you know, being a freedom fighter. And I didn't really know him through my childhood because he'd already moved out in the mid 60s and eventually tried to go to college for 1 year in Pakistan. But then when the war started in 60, well, of course, the PLO was formed in 65. I think he joined in 67. And anyway, he finally decided that, this is ski mosquito, keeps biting, you know? And then he decided that he wanted to get married. And my grandparents have a house in Irbid, Jordan. So we traveled to Irbid for his wedding. And we were there before he arrived, and he came in, and, you know, he was supposed to be there for only 2 weeks, get married, and then move back and get her paperwork done and then send for her. So during those 2 weeks, you know, I spent almost every day with him, you know, and he's the one who kind of seeded the idea in my head. He said, you know what, your behavior, your manners is completely American, you know, and you would fit in really well if you would move to the States. And I didn't really take much to that in the beginning, not until, you know, I got to high school and I started, you know, kind of paying attention, watching, you know, shows, especially then there was a show that was quite famous. It was called Dallas. I don't know if you remember that.
I think so. No.
Yeah, JR, who shot JR, you know, you need to Google that. But it's a famous sitcom or show that lasted for years, you know. It's called Dallas, and actually filmed in Dallas, and you could still go visit that house, you know, where it's like a historical marker now. You know, people go visit it from, you know, all over the world.
That's cool.
Yeah, so got more interested, you know, in that, so... I wrote him and I said, yeah, I'm interested. So what should I do? Okay, he said, go take the TOEFL test, the English equivalency, you know. So and if you pass it, you know, you can just come straight to university. If you don't pass it, you can come study English first. And then, so he sent me the paperwork and I applied for it. So I figured out, okay, I'm going to Denton. I learned that I'm not going to Dallas. I'm going to another town called Denton, you know. It was kind of, you know, different for me. And our school, Al-Jameel School, I stayed in it from first grade till 12th grade. So I knew everybody. The guys that were in my school, from first grade, they kept moving with me all the way to 12th grade. So I kind of grew up with these people. Like, that's why I say some of my best friends, except the ones that failed and got behind, you know. And it's hard to keep up with those guys, you know. But yeah, so we were like a very close-knitted group. And in high school, of course, the thing to do is, you know, you skip school, you go to the little supermarket and you buy cigarettes and you smoke cigarettes. You know, that's what you do. And so we used to go to this little supermarket and we'd keep our pack over there with him, and then we'd just get it and smoke a couple of cigarettes before class starts. And then there's actually an American school not very far away, and the American kids would do the same. They would come to the store and they'd buy cigarettes, and they they were and these two kids actually were there, and they with our broken English and basically got introduced and I learned that they are Texans and they're from Dallas. So like, hey, I'm coming to Denton. And then they told me so much about the area and what's going on and how it is, and you know, and that Denton had a university, it's all women. You know, it's like, oh, okay. That's interesting. but anyway, eventually, time come where, you know, it needs to go. I knew my father didn't have, you know, lots of income or means or savings. So I worked the summer of my 11th grade and the summer after high school, I worked as a maintenance guy in the engineering department at Sheraton Hotel. We had a relative that, you know, ran that department. And the first summer was just purely work. They paid us. I worked as many hours as they would give and saved up all the money. And then on the summer of the high school, I got really to know a lot of people there, and they asked me to bring some of my friends to work because they needed to finish on time. So I was working there with three or four of my friends, and we ended up doing business with them. We're buying the used furniture that they're getting rid of, and we started selling to the neighborhood. So we made really good money, you know, for kids in high school, you know. So I figured, you know, I'd go buy my airline tickets. So I paid my airline ticket myself, actually. Mm-hmm. I had enough money to do that. Anyways, so came to the States, 1979, straight to Denton. And that's when I realized that, yeah, you know, it can't get any better than that. This is the place to stay. I made up my pretty much early on. I mean, think about it. I mean, this is, I felt free here in a lot of ways, you know?
Can you elaborate more, like how and why? And yeah.
First of all, you know, being away from home for the first time as a male, young male, you know, that's very important, you know, where you don't have to answer to anybody. You pretty much have to make your own decision. So that on its own is a liberating feeling, you know? And I just wanted to blend. I didn't want to be a sore thumb. I literally, the first 2 weeks, I got rid of every bit of clothes that I brought with me. And I went and bought all my clothes from Kmart and Gibson's and all these, you know, just, you know, Western clothes, cowboy hat, boots, and you know, tennis shoes. And, you know, I wanted to look like everybody else. I didn't want to look, you know, foreign. And, you know, I made a point of making friends of the locals, you know, and basically not just completely isolate. Like a lot of the Arab students would just congregate with each other. They'd like move like packs, you know, they go drink coffee all together, or they'd go to the club together, or they would, you know, they're all just congregated, sit in the union building, big crowd, they're all smoking loud, you know. I kind of wanted to be a little different. You know, but the question that you ask, can I elaborate on how I felt that this is the place I'm going to stay? I mean, first of all, you could tell that there's so much opportunity, you know. You can see wealth all around you, and you can see that everybody speaks their mind, everybody's acted confident. There's no fear in their face whether to say this or that, you know. Even in Kuwait, where it's far away from any conflict, you still didn't feel comfortable speaking your mind, you know, because people had different political backgrounds, and people would judge you differently. But over in the States, when I came in, really, you could be whoever you want to be, you know. I mean, that's one of the first things I had to realize, that everything I grew up with as right and wrong really doesn't fit here. You know, I mean, people are thinking different. They have their own rights and wrongs, and who am I to judge, you know? So you have to kind of like adjust your way you think, you know? And that also opens your mind to new experiences. All that is just like, I was like a sponge, just absorbing all this. And it's really, I cannot describe. I wish that my kids would experience something like that, you know, where, you know, they get to kind of live two different personalities, you know. But of course, after the years, Maureen, and I don't know if you feel the same way, but, you know, we live our life here, but we still have that pull of our traditions and our culture. And so you still live for them. You still try to act proper certain situations and do that in that contradiction in our lives that just doesn't go away, you know, like, we do contrary things to what we first thought and believed, you know, but yet we're comfortable with it. You know what I mean?
I do. Would you feel comfortable sharing some of those contradictions that you've run into, that you've had, like, whether that's in conflict, like while raising your kids, who are wonderful people, by the way, or even with your own experiences before you had kids, just what some of those contradictions exist like, because I know what that feels like, but I'd love if you could elaborate.
I mean, it's hard to pin, you know, one or two of those contradictions, but there's enough of it that I could just mention one thing. I mean, the way we grew up, where men and women are separate, you know, I mean, like you don't mingle, you don't. Dating was not something that it's acceptable in society. Okay. You know, for a young woman to speak to a man outside being alone, it was a big no-no, especially, you know, in our community, being, you know, farming community, very, very strict, you know, in that sense. Even me as a male, you know, to have a girlfriend would have been something, you know, of course, you can't resist not have, you know, once you're here. And every guy I knew did. And a lot of them just lied their way to their parents that they are, you know, doing this and doing that, you know. So that's one obvious contradiction, you know. Well, drinking, you know, I mean, I drink, and I know that I didn't grow up We grew up thinking, you know, if you drink, that's a sin, and, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. But yet, almost everybody I knew did, you know. So even though you accept it and you're doing it, but in the back of your mind, you're doing something wrong. You know, it's just you kind of like just know that you're doing something wrong, and you said, okay, well, what the heck, I'm doing it anyway, you know. So a lot of these things that I, you know, still doesn't make me feel comfortable, but at least after I got older and more comfortable with myself, I no longer hide it. You know, I just, yeah, this is me. That's how I am. You know, even to my mom or my sisters, I just, you know, I'm not going to drink in front of them, but I'm not going to deny it, you know, or lie to them that I don't, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm a whole lot more comfortable. And if I feel that one day I'm not going to drink anymore, so be it. It's another choice, another time, another feeling. So I'm kind of accepting it that way. Mm-hmm. But back then when I was young, it was harder to kind of feel this way than feeling now. You know, it somehow you felt a bit of shame, you know, for doing the things you're doing, you know. And I mean, there's lots of these contradictions, you know, that I could, you know, go on and on about, you know, the way we were raised versus the way we live, you know. It's but at the end of the day, the other portion of it is, you know, I kind of lived here so long, and of course I married, you know, an American woman that born and raised here, you know, English and Dutch heritage. She did try her best to understand, you know, our culture, but there's no way that she's going to see it or feel it the way I feel it. And I became completely immersed in American culture, American mind. I dream in English. I pretty much caught on, you know, to every, the humor, the just the language itself. I'm so in depth. I'm much more in control of the English than Arabic sometimes, you know. But yet I still have that other part when I go back to Palestine and start speaking, you know, Falahi, the way I know how since the 60s, you know, people don't speak the way I speak anymore. They think I'm backward, you know, when I go back there. And they think, wow, you know, really? You live in America? You know, they don't accept it, you know, or they don't believe it. But I could make that transition. I could actually live the two lives. But there, so in my own psyche, I don't know where exactly I belong. Like, I would love to be able to say I could move back to the village and live and build me a house somewhere, you know, on top of the hill and kind of retire there. But I know that's impossible now. Being just realizing, before it used to be like more of a goal, but I know that now I can't do it. I mean, there's so much wrong over there. I mean, the health system is bad. The law, there's no protection. The police are really literally just, they're like ineffective. They can't really protect you. They're there for a totally different reason than, you know, so it's complicated. So I go and I see it and I enjoy the 2 weeks or 3 weeks that I go there, but then I can't wait to really get back to where I feel secure and safe here in the States, you know. I mean, that's a true feeling, you know. It's just, there's nothing.
No, I appreciate you sharing that. I understand it can be a complicated relationship, and it's hard to balance that sense of needing to move forward with life with like being attached to an identity that's still so meaningful and provides so much of your cultural and historical background. So I thank you for sharing that. And so when you said you moved to the U.S. in 79, and you went to college here because you had to do the TOEFL exam. Can you talk about college a little bit, your experiences through that? I know you alluded to some of them in terms of the contradictions and stuff, but maybe one of your favorite parts about college here.
Well, you know, when I first moved in, of course, the first thing that we had to study is English. So even though I did pass the TOEFL, but my uncle said, you know what, just take the course anyway, and you'll strengthen your English and your accent. And sure enough, that was actually a great experience because you get to go to school with people from different parts of the world, you know, from Thailand and South America, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Argentina, you know, Venezuela. There are people from all over, China, Japan. It was very colorful experience, those 4 months. You know, they took us on trips. It was like the honeymoon of being in the States, you know. Yeah, it was really fantastic. And then, of course, I started university at, UNT, which back then used to be called NTSU, North Texas State University, a different name. And went to my first football game. That was just out of this world. My cousin said, hey, let's go watch football. And I thought I was going to watch football, like what I know what football is, you know. But then all of a sudden they're playing with their hands. And I'm like, what the hell is this? How? You know, I mean, and then of course I noticed the cheerleaders and that was it, you know. But but again, you know, college got more exciting as I started to decide, yeah, I'm going to go into an engineering school. And NTSU did not have engineering. So my uncle said, well, stay as long as you can here. get your humanities, get your, you know, your math and whatnot. So I took as many classes as I could. Then I moved with a group of friends that wanted to, you know, they said, hey, there's a university in Beaumont, Texas, Lamar University. So it was actually a good university, but I did not like it. The town itself was kind of backward, filthy. And the university itself was kind of outside the city, so it felt isolated. Not like when we were in Denton, we were like in the middle of everything. But over there, it was kind of like to the side. Only a couple of stores that you can go to. And it was next to a refinery. And smelled really bad every morning. You know, the refinery, when they spill out the gas, you know, you know what it smells, H2S4. Which smells really horrible, like rotten eggs, you know, every morning. So, and I had to stay at least two semesters because I already committed to the program. As soon as I finished it, I went back to North Texas, to UT Arlington, actually, where this program is being done. And I studied there for about a year in UT Arlington, or less than a year, two long semesters, same like Beaumont. Until a group of my friends moved to El Paso and they said, hey, this is it. You know, come over here. It's really nice town. We go to Mexico every night, you know, and we just party there in Mexico till morning. All right, cool. So I moved to El Paso in 83. But I was thinking that, oh, I need to get settled. I need to get married. I need to kind of like stay. That's it. So I met my ex-wife, actually, Judy. I met Judy on the third day I was in El Paso. right after registration. So that was quite an introduction to El Paso, and that was the end of it. We were together about a year, and then we got married.
Wow. And so, because I know your kids, of course, I know that you guys had kids, and you mentioned earlier that, you know, your experiences in Palestine as a child, you wish you could take your kids to experience them the same way. Can I ask how can you talk a little bit about how the inability to do that affected your relationship with your kids or the way you would have raised them, for instance? I'm just trying to get at like what you think how you think the inability to experience Palestine the way you did and share that with your kids affected the way that, you know, you raised them and your relationship with them, if at all. Maybe it didn't.
Well, you know, I raised my kids when of course we had the divorce came in the middle. They were still young, and for a period of our life we moved to Dubai, and that period, in my mind I thought, okay, that would get them immersed in the culture and they would, you know, kind of learn Arabic and whatnot. It didn't work because everybody in Dubai wanted to speak English, and there's, you know, they want to be more westernized, and so it's the other way around. And also, you know, I was able to, you know, focus on them a little bit more, and I tried to get them to learn Arabic, but it didn't really work. And our marriage was kind of, you know, wasn't all that settled even then. So it was hard for me to focus on them. And one of the things that I really regret not doing is not push the Arabic language on them and speak with them in Arabic all the time. So my dad passed away in 1995. So in 1996, I actually took Susie, and Sarah to Palestine, and they stayed there the whole summer with their grandma. And miraculously, even in those 2 months of the summer, 2.5 months of the summer, after I came back to pick them up, they were speaking Falahi. You know? I mean, it's amazing, you know. Sarah was there. There's a swing in the backyard, and she was telling Jazz, "Zucchini, zucchini." like she hears the kids in the neighborhood talk, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's cute.
Yeah. So they got to experience that portion, but you know the things that I kind of just the freedom of being in the village, running around, going from place to place, getting into mischief, you know, just being like a local kid in there, you know, because your cousins basically just get you into their own mischief, you know, when you're there, and that's it. That's the end of that. That was hard for them to experience, you know. They were more sheltered. Mm-hmm. At least I thought so, but I'm sure they probably have a different memory of it.
Wow, we're already, have we been going this long? I didn't realize how late it is. I don't want to keep you too much longer, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. I didn't realize we've been here so long, but I basically just wanted to ask, I guess I'll leave this as the last question, because you've kind of explained your story pretty well through without me needing to even intervene. But I wanted to ask if you have anything that you wanted to add on to, anything that in related to what we spoke that you wanted to expand on, or something that maybe or something maybe you just want to put out there given the context of what you spoke about being like, you know, anything, whether it's like the cross-cultural aspect and trying to fit in different places and finally finding your home here, or if it's about something you didn't talk about at all that you wanted to mention also.
Well, one of the things I might, when you first started the interview, you asked me whether I prefer to go by Sal or Suleiman, mm-hmm. you know, and I said Suleiman because of you, Maureen, you're Palestinian, mm-hmm. but with everybody else here, I much rather when somebody asks you, I'll just say Sal. And the reason I say that, because once I say Suleiman, they want to know a story. Why? Who are you? For from wrong. You know, and then you end up telling the same story that you told maybe a million times before, you know, and then you're immediately put in that category. You know, you're no longer just a, you know, I'm a local here in El Paso, but the minute that I identify as Suleiman and they know where I'm coming from, if they don't already know me, you know, if it's a new meet, I'm already, I get put in that category, you know, the Palestinian, the Arab guy, you know, they forget everything else I said about my experience in engineering and land development. And, you know, that becomes secondary to how I identify myself, you see? And that's something, you know, you learn to live with being here as an Arab, as a Muslim, as a Palestinian, in Texas especially. I mean, I'm lucky here in El Paso where people are less, less right wing. when I go to East Texas, or, you know, like when I attend these meetings at the Association of Builders, and mostly just good old boys that even though they're educated and they understand the difference and where you're coming from, but still you're so far off the spectrum from, you know, from what they grew up seeing, you know, mm-hmm. even though there's so many immigrant communities in Texas, that's still kind of different mm-hmm. for them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, in a lot of ways, I much prefer say Sal, you know, when I'm just anywhere, go to the city or the county or any municipality, that's it, you know, Sal, so don't ask me anymore, you know, I don't want to tell the story again, but it still comes up. Whether I like it or not, it still comes up, you know? And so it's always a reminder that yeah, I've been here well over 40 years. Pretty much everybody I meet right now, I've been here longer than they live, maybe twice sometimes. But they still, once they know Suleiman, I'm like don't belong as much as they are.
And do you, okay, I know I said the last one was the last question, but do you have any words of advice you would share to fellow Muslims who might feel that same otherness that you just described? If let's say somebody was listening to the interview and they heard you talk about why you call yourself Sal instead of Suleiman, and they said, you know, I can totally relate to that, and that's something I understand. Would you have any general advice for those kind of people who are trying to find their sense of belonging the same way that you found yours?
Well, I sometimes admire some of these, you know, guys where, you know, they're strict and they pray five times a day, and they make the mosque their life, and they're good, wholesome people. And whether they choose to limit their life to that or experience anything outside of it, you know, that's a choice they make. You know, even sometimes the way they dress totally different with, you know, serwal kameez and a gafiya, and they walk like that outside, you know. That's a choice they make. There's no way I can advise them any other way, you know. But if there is somebody who is very proud of being Muslim, like me, I am very proud. I never deny it. I never, you know, but I'm not militant about it, where if somebody, you know, were to kind of say, I try to convince them in a good way, you know, why Islam is not it's not an extremist religion. There's no way there's a misinterpretation. But if somebody wants to blend in and wants to have a successful business, let's say that you, not to say that you couldn't, you know, everybody adapts to their own needs. But at least for me, I figured this would be easier and makes it less strange when I'm conducting business, you know, with people. Just as but once I get to know them and everything, and they know who I am, it's different. But once they're comfortable, but the first impression, which is important in a lot of ways, you know, people want to judge you really quick, you know. I chose to go by, you know, a different name or something more. I always thought to myself, like, if I was back home, let's just say, when I was raised in Kuwait, okay? And in my school, you know, everybody named Ahmed, Muhammad, Hazim, Adil, Ibrahim, you know, and then you get this one guy, Leonard, okay? So like, he's different, totally. Immediately, as soon as he says his name, you ask him where they're from, why do they have this name, blah, 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 you know, and every kid treated him like he's not part of this culture, like he's different. So it goes both ways, whether you're here or there. So I figured if this guy, instead of just went by Leonard and just, you know, say, you know, I'm Lu'ay, you know, he would have absolutely no problem with anybody. So I kind of gauged it like that, because I in my school, there were several kids that had, you know, Western names that they got kind of singled out, you know. Mm-hmm. Even though they treated them the same, we played soccer together, we played basketball and volleyball, and we hung out and smoked cigarettes together, but still, you got that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing and contextualizing that further. I think that was really helpful in understanding the distinction in it. You know, it's something that a lot of people, I'm sure, have asked about before too. So I appreciate you sharing that. But that's pretty much all I had, Suleiman. I can go ahead and stop the recording unless there's anything else you want to ask. Okay, let me go ahead and pause it here. Let me stop it.
So late with you now.